President Higgins, how are you doing?
I'm great. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for being with us. Really appreciate it. I wanted you to tell the audience just a little bit about Carvin. Who is Carvin? Where is he from? And what does he do?
Well, Carvin Higgins is a father, a son, a brother. He's a reverend, Sunday school teacher. He's a motivational speaker. He's a fighter for those who can't fight, a voice for those who are afraid to speak. In my profession, I'm a Grammy Award winning, multi-platinum album producing and selling artist, writing, creator.
Awesome. Awesome. And you're from Philadelphia.
Yes, born in Philadelphia, raised in Savannah, Georgia till I was 12 years old, and then shaped back in Philadelphia from 12 until now.
Talk about your growing up. What was that like being, you know, you're talking about East Coast and Southeast.
Well, I, as a kid, if we go all the way back, yeah, I remember everything all the way back to when I was 3 years old, but we moved to Savannah, Georgia when I was three, and in Savannah, Georgia, I kind of fell in love with music. I just remember being 8 years old, 9 years old, and we had a stereo, but the speakers didn't work, and I figured out how to wire the speakers to make it work. And so when I was supposed to be going to sleep to go to school the next morning, I would sit up all night and listen to the radio until until 6 in the morning, and I would go to school and come home. But the records that I would hear were just so powerful, and they resonated with my soul. It was just, I don't know why I was feeling that deep as a kid, but it was just wonderful. So then my older brother, his name is Leon, Alfonso Leon Higgins, we used to make songs up. You know, my mom was a single mom, and she was a working mom, so we would be home starving. So my brother would make up these games, and then he would have us all create these songs, and we would just make up songs to help us forget that we were hungry until my mom came home. So I guess it all came from there, you know.
Now, you're mentioning something. You were raised by a single mom, but you had to find creative ways to not only survive, but to pass the time. So you're doing something constructive, you know. You're creating.
Yeah.
And now that's a real big key in keeping your mindset in on a positive note. I'm sure you had temptations to, you know, hang out in the street or do whatever, but was the way you were raised, you and your brother and family, was that a key factor in you in helping you not to get out in the street or, you know, be destructive?
Well, I mean, I can't say I was out in the street as well. I definitely was out in the street as well, but the greatest thing is that my big brother was like my superhero. So I never wanted to do anything that would upset him or like, you know, not be good for him. So, or for how he looked, you know.
You're saying that the music from a young age moved you. What was it? Can you get a little bit deeper and tell us what in that music? Were you more of a lyricist, or were you more of somebody creating, drills or runs, as they call them, through music? Did you play a musical instrument as a kid?
Well, what's funny is I played the trumpet for a while because my older brother played the trumpet. But then I saw Dizzy Gillespie's cheeks, and I decided I didn't want my cheeks to look like that playing trumpet. So I put the trumpet down. But when it came to music, my mom was a DJ at one time, and in Philadelphia she used to dance with a band here in Philadelphia before we went to Savannah, Georgia. But when it comes to the music, it was always the lyrical content. It was there was so much emotion and evoking in the lyrics and the voice of the artist and the words of the song that, like I said, I don't understand between 8 and 12 years old why I was so connected to these records. Like, Me and Mrs. Jones was like one of my favorite records by Billy Paul, or Wake Up Everybody, No More Sleeping in Bed. I would hear that every morning when I wake up and my mom was getting me ready for school. So all of these records were just so powerful. I remember having, my mom bought me a portable 8-track tape player. And the 8-track tape that she bought me was the Michael Jackson 5 APC 8-track tape. And I used to sit in my rocking chair with my headphones on and rock and listen to this thing over and over and over and over again.
Wow. Now, you're a lyricist. Now, that brings us to something rather interesting. Words go into your soul. You know, you're speaking that you are a father, a minister, and lyrics pretty much have shaped your life. Now, in terms of your personal being as a teenager, what were you listening to at that time? Because you talk about the classics, and all of us are raised with a lot of different classics, whether it be our mom's music or grandmom's music or whatever. Music, good music is good music. What were you listening to growing up, and what were you shaped by?
Now, what's funny is that around the time, getting into my teenage years, 12, Prince, Morris Day was everything to me. That just was it. Rick James was everything to me. But they always seemed like my mother's music or my older brother's music or my older sister's music. But when hip-hop came into play, when real hip-hop came into play, that felt like it was my music. It felt like it was my generation, and we discovered it. So I was kind of enthralled into the idea and overwhelmed by the idea of hip-hop to the point that I became a rapper. I used to be a rapper. But the fun thing about my raps, they were all, like, positive message raps. It was always like storytelling and showing people the world, how it looks, and it's not as beautiful as you say it is, or you may see the beautiful side, but here's the side that's being ignored. It was always some type of message in my rap lyrics that, you know, were for the people, as well as I used to be a battle rapper too.
Rap started out as message music in the late 60s, whether you're talking about Blowfly or you know, many of the other legends of rap. I mean, it only became a term of hip-hop probably in the 90s. Were you influenced by Pinkett Markham or any of the early rappers who were actually talking about socioeconomic issues and relational issues?
Well, yeah, definitely. You know, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, The Message, was one of the records. I still know that song word for word. It's funny because people will say, well, you know, Rapper is Delight, you should know that word for word. But I actually don't know that word for word. I know The Message word for word because that record stood out to me, you know. Every aspect of hip-hop is what I love. You know, I listen to Kumo D, The Treacherous Three. I listen to all of those earlier guys coming in. And then, of course, Run DMC came in, and they were kind of dressed like us. And LL Cool J, he was our age when he came out. So, and then Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. So, you know, all that hip-hop. KRS-One used to be my favorite rapper. Is one of my favorite rappers just because of the knowledge he would put in his lyrics. It was always something knowledgeable. And as well as Rakim, same thing, was always a positive messaging, and he never cursed in his records. So it was just like, you know.
You're talking about some of the, what they deem now pioneers in terms of rap, but rap took a turn. And you have the New Jack coming in the late 80s and 90s, and then the rise of what they term gangster rap. My father was always saying, "No, the black folks are gangsters," you know. And I tell my older brother that, when were they ever gangsters? What did you think about the term? Because things have to evolve. But were you surprised at the evolution that in that direction?
Well, you know what's funny about gangster rap, and a lot of people don't know this, that it actually originated in Philadelphia by a guy named by the name of Schoolie D. That he was the original gangster rapper, and then Ice-T kind of took the style from him, and then Eazy-E took the style from Ice-T. But if you go back and listen to N.W.A.'s first album, they called it gangster rap, but they actually were like pro-black teenager rap, right? So they had a song called Express Yourself. And in that song, Dr. Dre says, "I don't smoke weed or sip because it's known to give a brother brain damage, and brain damage on the mic don't manage nothing." And and when you listen to the Straight Outta Compton album, they had the song F the Police. And basically the song was about how the police are brutalizing young black men in our community, and we are upholding them like the law to protect us, but really forget them because they don't care nothing about us. So their first album was more like the voice of the young black men in the ghetto of wanting to get out but dealing with all the pressure. Now, the second album, when that came out, it was a little outrageous. Even Eazy-E had a record on his album called Dope Man, and it seemed like he was glorifying the drug dealer, but at the end of the record, if there's a guy that comes in and say, "Dope Man, if my sister died because of your drugs, then I'm going to have to get you out of here." You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, you know, they made it gangster rap when it actually really was like the frustrations of young, the voice of the frustrated young black man who's doing everything he can to be right, but the police and the powers that be keep calling them wrong, calling them bad when they're really not doing anything bad.
Amen. I'm glad that you were able to explain that. Lyrics, I'm glad we're talking about the lyrics because it's helped to shape your life. In terms of being a lyricist and delivery in music, in the, I guess, the last couple decades, even more now, we've had people who are amazing singers. But when I study music and go back to my grandfather's age and whatnot, there's certain types of vocal delivery that can tell a story in a song. And I'll just mention one person you probably know. David Ruffin was never a songwriter, but he could interpret a song like "I Wish It Would Rain" or, you know, "I'll Never Love Another After Loving You." He made you feel the lyrics. I mean, truly feel the lyrics. He painted his vocal delivery explained a picture. It's like a story he's telling, and you have to really listen through the song from beginning to end. You don't hear that an awful lot. You hear some great singers, but not great interpreters of lyrics. But in rap, I hear it. I hear, you know, delivery like when I listen to a Green Marie. And others, I'm thinking, wow, these people, you know, you have to actually listen to Kendrick Lamar. Talk about being a lyricist and the people that you work with and how to bring a message to the people so the music doesn't overpower the message.
Yeah, you know, what's great, I mean, I love words, and I think words are, of course, that's the way we communicate, but I do believe that words can penetrate the psyche and penetrate the heart. And that, definitely as a lyricist, I make it my business to make sure that the words always give a message of inspiration or information or education that within a story that as a listener, you can get lost in that story and almost put your life in that same story. So the goal in writing is to make the songs that we create almost like the story of your life, but it's my life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you can put your life in it because I've made it so generally specific, right? It's general that you can put your name in it, but it's specific to the emotion that we all going to feel one day. So I make it my goal to do that, and I learned that from Kenny Gamble, Leon Huff. I learned that from Smokey Robinson. I learned that from Burt Bacharach. I learned it from Lionel Richie, which is one of my favorite writers. I just, that art of storytelling is unbelievable. It's incredible and it's compelling. So I always study those guys because the best way to get a message across is through words. So that's what we do. And the greatest thing is to have that artist that can interpret that and what we do as writers, we'll have a conversation. I know what I do is before I write for an artist, I have to interview that artist to make sure we're on the same vibe, we understand each other, you understand what you're doing with this art. Before I give you my gift that's given to me, I need to make sure you know how to handle the gift that I'm going to give. But we'll discuss your life, and once I discuss your life and I hear what's going on, I can write you a song that's custom built for your life, but general enough that anybody can put their life in it.
I saw a clip of you talking to young teenagers, and you were basically motivating them to, you know, aspire to dream higher and be bigger. And, you know, when you use the word I, you know, it really empowers you, especially if you're able to keep that mantra up. You know, I am successful, I am strong, I am healthy, I'm, you know. I'm wondering, though, you mentioned something to those kids, and you said that someone in your family had always said that, you know, you're just like, you know, another family member, your father, you're this, you're that. Now, how did that affect you? Because words that are told to us by loved ones, some people can feed into that and hold that forever. How were you able to overcome that?
Well, you know what happened was, I was raised in the Nation of Islam. I'm Christian now, I'm a reverend now, but I was raised in Islam, in the Nation of Islam. And one of the things that they made us understand as kids that we are kings and we come from a long line of kings, and don't ever look at yourself less than that. So when it got to the point that my mother would say, you ain't going to be ish just like your father, you know, in my mind, I'm saying, well, obviously you weren't paying attention when we were in the mosque, because they said, I'm a king. And they showed me in history where I'm a king and I come from kings. So I don't know who my father is, but I'm going to be a king because that's where I come from. And that's always been my mindset, and it's just always been the way I believe that whatever it is I put my mind to do, I can do it. It's not a question of can is not an option, or no is not an option either. Whatever my mind is set on, I can do it. And it was just, that was instilled in me as a young man.
Awesome. Yeah, you wanted to be a rapper. You started out, you know, thinking that that's what you were going to be. When did you get in partnership with Ivan?
Well, I started, I was a rapper, and then in that I started working for a company called Up and Up Productions, which was owned by a guy named Harold Russell. And in that company, we did commercials for the local radio station here. And when we did those jingles, we would go to a place called the Record Pool where all of the DJs would go and get the new records. So when we walked in that place, DJ Jazzy Jeff was there. And I said to the guy, Harold, I'm like, yo, Jazzy Jeff is over there. I'm going to go talk to him. He's like, nah, man, we bigger than Jazzy Jeff. And I was like, dude, Jazzy Jeff come on TV every Monday night at 8 o'clock. We're not bigger than him. So I need to talk to him. So I went in and I talked to him and told him who we were. He was like, yeah, I know, heard about you guys. You're doing really good on the radio, whatever the case may be. We exchanged numbers. And from that, I continued my friendship with him, just in communication, going down, hanging out with him or whatever.
And he said he was in the process of starting a new company and bringing in some producers and writers and all of that stuff. So I'm in the camp of Jazzy Jeff, A Touch of Jazz, which is owned by Jazzy Jeff. Ivan Barrios, I met him there. And in the duration of us working, there was six of us there, myself, Darren Henson, Keith Pelzer, Andre Harris, Vidal Davis, and Ivan Barrios. We were all learning and getting better and producing and landing projects. But Ivan, the way he worked, he was never there when the artist was there. So I told him, you know, give me your music, and I'm going to write something to it, and I'm going to get you a single, because all of us are being successful, but you keep missing the boat. So I'm just going to, I'll pick it. I'm going to make it work. So from that, we did the Just Friends record for Music Soul Child, and then and then we did a song called Paparazzi on Music's first album, and that chemistry just worked so well that that's just what we continued. And when we all left the Touch of Jazz, we broke off in pairs. So Darren Henson and Keith Pelzer went as a team, Andre Harris and Vidal Davis went as a team, and myself and Ivan Barrios left as a team.
Awesome. You know, I'm looking at the people, everyone from Brian McKnight and Mary J. Blige, Belle Biv DeVoe, Keisha Cole, Faith Evans, Angie Stone, Chris Brown, Justin Timberlake, Tupac. You know, this is over Kenny Lattimore. I'm looking at so many names, and many I'm leaving out, including now Green Marie, that you have worked with, but we're talking over almost like a 15, 17 year period. And it's called the music business. You're in the business. And
yeah.
I want you to tell my audience what keeps you grounded. I know you'll say God, but, you know, there are a lot of temptations there, and a lot of people you might hear from 2 or 3 years. They may come out with a hit, then you don't hear from them no more. So you guys have been able to be grounded and stay in this game for quite some time.
Well, what happens is this. You can't work under a DJ Jazzy Jeff and Will Smith and act like you're about to be the guy with all of the diamonds and jewelry when those guys don't even wear none of that stuff. It's like you'll be out in place in the studio with all of this jewelry on, and these guys sitting around looking regular, and they're the ones with the most money. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So that was one part of it. And then the other part of it is that at no time can I take credit for this gift that I have. So for me to feel like it's me and get full of myself, I feel like I would lose everything that I've accomplished, because it's never been me anyway. This is God working through me. So I don't want to take any credit of God's for my own, because it's just not good.
I love that answer. In your spiritual quest, because I know you say you're a minister and whatnot, I'm reading a lot of the philanthropy and things that you're doing right there in the Philly area, and it's carrying to those of us who aren't in the Philly area on a regular basis. Rage Against the Ratchet, I believe I even called you. I was really impressed with that, and about the messages that are being sent to everybody through radio and music.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I started the movement called Rage Against the Ratchet because the music started to become, I mean, we've definitely had some very derogatory music in my day of hip hop, but the one thing that it never did was make it to radio. It was always, you got to go find that on your own to get that record. Like, Rage, you're not just going to hear that on radio. You got to go personally buy it and play it in your own home at your own time. So I noticed that the music on the radio just started getting way and way out of control, very heavy in suicide, very heavy in drug use, very heavy in murder, very heavy in money, derogatory statements. I disrespected the women, disrespected the church. It just became, I guess, it just a whole bunch of debauchery. And I felt like, yo, this is not good for this to be playing at 7 a.m. When a mother is getting a kid ready for school, this is on the radio. And when a kid is coming home from school, this is on the radio. And this is the time that the children are listening. So I just felt like, it was important to try to figure out how we can bring a stop to it, or at least create an awareness of this is what's happening, because the parents' ears are turned off to the music. As soon as they hear it, they're like, I don't want to hear that junk. You can listen to it. And they don't know someone is in their child ear like, yeah, you can rape her, put something in her drink and rape her. You know what I'm saying? The music is telling your child to do all of these things, and you're trying to figure out, my child was a good student, and now he's busting windows and acting crazy. It's like, yeah, well, you listen long enough, you'll believe it.
Well, I'm going to ask a controversial question. How much is it of the artists, the radio, and the people who are producing this stuff and putting it in the community, especially urban communities? So that's where it's at.
Well, here's what I've learned in being in the music industry. We were offered to or called in to create music for artists. When we got there, basically, they said to us, we played them the music, this is great, the kids will love it, but you don't have no music like what they're listening to. And it's like, what do you mean? Like, this is a great record, but we need some of that other stuff, because radio won't play it unless it has that in it.
Wow.
And, yeah, so I'm like, well, if that's the case, then you're going to have to go find the people that create that, because that's not what I do. And I left it there, but everything was coming from the label. The influence is the label to tell the creator to make the music, but the music that they want to hear is the music they feel like only radio will only play this music.
Wow. So basically, they are trying to tell you what to do.
Right. They're trying to tell me
scary.
What to do and what the people will like. So I need to give them what the people will like.
Now that's scary. It truly is. When you get any entity that can tell a creator, well, you got to do what we say. The music, though, music is actual music, jazz influences and others are starting to come back. I remember one of my favorites is George Clinton. He was saying that there's only but so many hooks and grooves in this, and even rap. He goes, certainly it's going to have to come back to music. So now you hear a lot more music in the music, and some positive lyrics, including the ones that Carvey and Ivan are producing for many artists. What do you think about the music future? Do you see that classic music will come back a little bit more, and we'll watch
see
bands again, and people play the instruments? And
you know what's crazy? I just believe that everything comes full circle, and I think that everything has to implode before it's actually back to normal, right? So there's like, here's an example. Me and my artist, Bria Marie, were talking. And we were talking about the extreme of female artists. And I was like, the way I see it, it's going to have to go back to normal. And she was like, what do you mean? I said, well, we were talking about Lady Gaga. And I said, well, if you look at Lady Gaga, she's done everything extreme as she can possibly do. She's dressed in meat. She's dressed in blood. She's been as crazy as she could possibly do. So the only way now that she can shock people is to come back normal.
Mm-hmm.
And she did the record with Tony Bennett and came back normal. And they loved her for it. I said, and that's pretty much what's going to happen to the music industry. It's so out of control that it has to come back to normal, because you can't outdo the crazy that's out there. We're at the peak of crazy.